broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, guys, and happy Friday on this very, very cold Melbourne morning. How are you all?
Cold.
Very good.
Good morning. Very well, thanks.
How was your bike ride in, Brett?
Very fresh. Yeah, good way to wake me up. Didn't need a coffee. Well, even though I had one anyway. But, yeah, the cold was enough to keep me awake.
Yeah, it's certainly settled into winter now, that's for sure.
Time.
I bet.
Yes, well, we're definitely in it. It's, we're a few days into winter officially now, aren't we?
Very sadly, yes.
True. Yeah.
But are you guys winter people or are you summer people?
I'm both.
I'm definitely a summer person for sure.
Yeah, Joel doesn't mind the cold.
Hmm? I like the cold. When winter comes around, it's the snow season, and when summer comes around, it's the beach season, and when autumn comes around, it usually means the footy season's kicking off, and when spring comes around, it usually means it's finals time and spring racing carnival. So, what isn't there to love about four seasons in Melbourne?
I agree.
Not a lot on my part. I like the humidity as well. So that's something that not a lot of people like. But I love Singapore's kind of weather and that really humid, sticky weather, which Joel hates. So.
Yeah.
I think
you probably have the heater on all the time,
Steph,
too.
True. I do have the heater on 27 normally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always tropical at our place. Hey, I just wanted to kick off the conversation this morning over a couple of things. We're in a recession. Is this correct? This is all this hype on the news. Are we in a recession? Is it true?
It's the big headline, and it's got a lot of people scared. It's true that we will, when we come out of this, we will in hindsight record Australia's economy as going into a recession. And here's the thing about what makes a technical recession or not a technical recession. A recession is usually only identified in hindsight because you've got two quarters in a row. So one period that might be January to March, and another period that might be April to June, where you've got a negative rate of GDP. So GDP in one quarter is lower than the quarter before that. And it was actually a 50-50 chance that Australia would not record a technical recession through this coronavirus period of time, which would have been just ridiculous, because what the government was hoping for was that the January to March period of time would come in just very slightly positive. And then all of the negative impact of coronavirus they were hoping would have been recorded in April to June, and then come July to September, showing the economy as having being slightly higher than the period before it. So there was actually a window for Australia not to record a technical recession, which just goes to show how silly that kind of measurement is, and also how silly it is that a headline would come out now saying that we're going to go into a recession. I think if you didn't already know that fact, then I don't think you've been paying much attention for the last 2 months about what's going on in the world around us.
So you think the media are just trying to cause a bit of hype, though, for people? And what's the rationale for doing this or calling it so late?
Well, they couldn't call it before now, because it's only now that the January to March figure has been announced, and that's why that headline came out this week. Because if that data had been slightly different, well, then they wouldn't have been able to write that headline because it wouldn't have applied. It's a strange thing where the measure of it is silly in the first place, but no one really has questioned it, and people still use it, and therefore articles get written about this silly old measure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of pain that's going to come. And I know a lot of my friends in businesses that are certainly starting to feel the pinch of job losses right now. So it's certainly well and truly taking effect.
Yeah. And there's actually some writing that we might already be on our way out of the recession. If all of the pain has pretty much been felt by now, well, actually, then we are now maybe in the recovery phase of this, and we've now got some new programs being announced and measures put in place to see us through to the other side of it. Certainly, the restrictions lifting is helping. So cafes and things are opening again. So people are starting to come back into their jobs. So
certainly the hospitality side of it, but I just wonder more about, you know, office workers and things like that. So certainly from what I'm seeing, it's starting to take a pinch now, though, for those people that are in sort of office roles instead.
Yeah.
Well, you're starting – I think what you're seeing, what you're trying to say, Steph, is that many businesses are now using this as an opportunity, or are now being forced to reckon with the staffing levels that they have versus the activity that they're currently seeing within their businesses, and trying to make adjustments to adapt to the new environment that we're currently operating in. And so, yes, we had the crisis and we had the peak of the pandemic a couple of months ago, but that's now forcing businesses to reassess their longer-term financial commitments to staff levels, offices, those types of things. And so you're seeing restructures and potential redundancies starting to come through now.
I've
seen businesses that have gone to the wall, and gone to the wall quickly because they just had no contingency plan there. I've seen other businesses whose businesses have actually picked up because they're somewhat advantageously positioned for this situation. But we're now going to see those businesses who have suffered maybe a little bit, maybe a lot, but been able to get through it so far. But now that we're into the third month of dealing with this situation, there's some businesses that are on life support that they're just not going to make it unless they make significant change. And the other thing is, what we didn't have 2 months ago was much foresight into the future. We could only really see what was going to happen next week and not much beyond that. We're now coming into a situation where we can start to see what the next maybe 2 months, 3 months, or 6 months is actually going to look like. And that's a scary thing for some businesses to be able to do, because then they can actually see that it's not looking like a good situation for them and how they're positioned for the next 6 months. So it is very tough times for some people, and we feel for them.
Yeah. I will also touch on the fact that Joel and I headed out for a dinner with some friends the other night, and I don't know about you. I don't know if you have been out to dinner after the restrictions have eased, but I almost felt guilty being out and being in an Uber. Sort of even sitting down for a restaurant, it was kind of a sensory overload to have dinner out and be with people. It kind of was kind of finding what to do again and how it all works. So
it was a bit awkward, wasn't it, Steph?
It was.
I didn't know what to do with my hands, with my arms, how to sit, how to, you know, where to look.
Is that because you haven't held a fork for the last 3 months? You've been eating so at home with your hands or something?
Yeah. Just eating hamburgers and it was a weird feeling. Even the restaurant that we went to, which was a lovely restaurant, they were also a little bit disorganized themselves. A bit rusty, a bit dusty. They were sort of stepping over each other and bumping into each other a little bit and running around. And I think that they tried to staff the business for the expected level of patrons that would visit. But I think they might have perhaps been just a little bit short and running around and rushing. So everyone's getting used to it.
It was quite a surreal feeling too. We had a group of eight with us, and we had to split the tables into two lots of four. So you're sort of waving to your mates down the other end of the restaurant. So kind of strange. Anyway.
On a positive note, we can say that not only are restaurants coming back, but we've also got sport coming back. We've had the NRL come back last weekend. We've got the AFL coming back next week. We've got the NBA have just announced that they're going to restart their season in late July. Yep. The NHL, the hockey season, look like they're going to restart their season also in the coming weeks. We've got the EPL starts again on the 17th of June, the English Premier League. And we've got the Supercross has also started already this week. So, you know, you can tell
Joel's excited.
It doesn't get much better than that, except for the...
Joel, do you want to talk about the cardboard cutouts that people have been buying at the sport? Can I briefly touch on that?
Yeah, well, that's quite funny, isn't it, really? You've seen in the NRL they've allowed a number of members to buy their own image in the crowd, and some people obviously have tried to take the mickey out of this, and you've seen all sorts of characters show up in the crowd. You've seen some serial killers. You've seen you've seen some
family pets.
You've seen famous political figures.
Got to have a little bit of fun with it, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
I think they've put a stop to that now. I don't think anyone was really checking what they were printing at the time, so no one cared too much. But I think they've cottoned on.
They have cottoned
on. So on that, Joel, at the moment, as of right now, we're second on the ladder. But by this time next week, when we sit here, we will be first.
That would make sense. Yeah. Well, given that we're going to beat Richmond and pretty much everybody else this season, yes.
Well, we'll be the first to two wins, so we'll have to be first.
Yes, exactly.
Right, you Collingwood supporters, we're going to kick off now today's conversation. Oh, I know you're excited, but we're moving into the hot topics of the day. So, Joel, I'm going to throw over to you. You're going to talk to us today about the top earning CEOs over the past 5 years. What have you got to say about that?
Well, yes, there is a report in the AFR today that a group called Ownership Matters have done a study on Australia's top 20 chief executives in terms of what they've earned over the past 5 years. Interestingly enough, on that list are a couple of guys who you perhaps wouldn't expect to be on that list, because when you have a look at how they've been remunerated versus how they've actually performed, you would very much question whether or not they were worth the money. The biggest earner on the list, does anyone have an idea of who the biggest earner on that list would have been over the past 5 years?
So this is Australia only?
This is Australia only, yep.
Is it Pratt?
No. I'll give you a clue. They're called the Millionaires Factory for a reason.
Macquarie.
Macquarie Bank.
Mm.
Nicholas Moore. Moore made $117.5 million over the 5 years being the Macquarie boss. He just pipped the Domino's CEO, Don Meij, I think his name is. I don't even know how you say that. M-E-I-J. How do you say that?
Meij, is it Meij?
Yeah.
Who made $72.9 million from a combination of realized equity through options and also cash payments as remuneration.
Wow, so, that's money for pizza.
Yeah, there's money in pizza. There's definitely money in pizza.
Yeah, and he probably hasn't paid for any food that whole time.
No, exactly. So, but we also note that there's a few characters on this list that you would perhaps think don't deserve their position. Most notably, Boral's Mike Kane. The AFR talks about Mike Kane, and when you think about the fact that he has delivered 6 profit downgrades over recent years, and yet he's pocketed somewhere around about $31 million in total compensation over that period of time, of which the vast majority actually came from share compensation, so exercising share options. You would wonder how somebody can make $31 million where they've been issuing consecutive downgrades over that six-year period of time, yet still getting the ability to exercise very lucrative share options and banking that. Mm. We also note that Challenger Financial, the group that does all the annuities.
Yes.
So Challenger's CEO Benari, he's pocketed $40 million in compensation, of which only $10.8 million of that was in cash payments, and the rest coming from share options that he was able to exercise. Now, when you have a look at
their annuities have such low yields.
Yeah.
Well, and not just that, Louis, Challenger's share price is actually lower today than what it was 5 years ago. So how do you make 75% of your compensation in share incentive payments when your share price has actually gone backwards over the last 5 years?
It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's gone backwards because of all the dilution he's created.
Well, potentially, yeah. Wow. That's exactly right.
Well, he's still standing though, isn't he?
So this raises the old question. Well, how do you determine who is a strong management team? And we've always sort of espoused that where possible, you want to invest your money with founder-led companies. We tend to find that founder-led businesses tend to be the more entrepreneurial type of businesses. They tend to be managed much more financially prudent. They tend to be seen these businesses tend to be an extension of the founder's ego, so they tend to have more buy-in to the performance of the business and its share price performance. And we tend to find that executive-led companies tend to consistently underperform founder-led businesses, and there's been numerous studies over time that have showed that when given the choice, you should always err on the side of investing your money with those people who have real stake in the game. Yeah. Unfortunately, and this is where many famous investors such as your Carl Icahns and who are corporate raiders, they've made a fortune out of being able to disrupt these terrible businesses that have, you know, huge executive compensation payment schemes, and they've come in and they've taken big stakes in these businesses, turned over the board, sacked management, and made themselves huge profits by essentially being corporate raiders and doing away with these types of unfair compensation schemes that don't look after the shareholders. So unfortunately, as individual investors, we don't have the ability to be able to do those types of shareholder activism. But you can clearly see that in many instances it certainly is a boys' club, and many of these executives still tend to get away with subpar performance and huge salaries, and you can understand from time to time why the worker who works for these businesses gets upset.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's pretty much all I've got to say on that topic. In regards to the market, we're seeing that in the very short term, many of the stocks that have been leading the market higher are starting to show some signs of running into some resistance here. It's more likely than not that we're seeing a continual rotation out of the leaders into some laggards. That will likely continue to persist for the next few weeks. But I think longer term, we're still seeing that most things tend to be showing that the worst of the downturn is behind us and that the recovery is ahead of us. So it still makes sense to be looking for really great businesses that are setting up nicely at a well-formed basis and looking to buy them when they're breaking out. But just being aware that in the next few weeks we might see some weakness, and that's just part and parcel of the game. Seeing a 5% to 7% correction here is not beyond the realms of a possibility. But we would caution about getting too concerned right now, and that most of this pullback should be considered to be a buy the dip opportunity.
Good one, Joel. All right, well, thank you for that update. We're going to take a very quick break and we're going to be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, guys. We're now going to actually throw over to Brett. Brett, you're going to talk us through the government home builder scheme, which we touched on very briefly last week. It's now in effect. Tell us what we need to do to get our hands on that money if you're a first home buyer.
Can do, Steph. Now, yes, we did touch on it last week. Well, you touched on it last week before we really knew a lot about it. So you're ahead of the curve there.
Ahead of the curve.
You sure were.
Yep. You're our insider now, so we're going to be asking you to tell us all the topics for our next coming episodes. Before I get into the details of it, I want to mention a part of it that is not a you can't be serious, even though it could be taken for one. I don't know if any of you saw on the news, it was announced by the Prime Minister in a newly created suburb just outside of Canberra called Googong. And so it's a new housing estate with a lot of construction, which is like they tend to do. They always make sure they make announcements relevant to the back. Yeah, exactly, Louis. But because there was a number of new houses and new properties being built, they managed to stand on the nature strip of a recently built house.
The owner
came out. You did see it. And it was quite funny because the owner saw all the media and everyone else, and he came out and told them to move on because they were standing on his newly seeded lawn.
That's hilarious.
It was good.
He threw them for a six, actually. I mean, he just didn't care who they were. He's like, get off. You're like, you need to move off the lawn.
Get off the lawn.
Yeah, and just the way he said it, it was very Australian just to come out and tell the Prime Minister to get off the
lawn. Absolutely. Scott Morrison looked a bit embarrassed.
So it got off to a good start. The package, if you read the headline, it says that it's a home builder package, but it also allows you to do to home renovations, and they're offering $25,000 for people to upgrade or build their homes. The first reaction I imagine most people would have is, great, I can finally build that deck or that new kitchen for free, but it's not quite that simple. There needs to be a minimum spend, and there's some other criteria. So the government are forecasting around 27,000 homeowners or builders will access this scheme. And to put that in perspective, there's currently, according to their stats, 7.7 million private dwellings in Australia. So not a big take up in that respect, and that's probably due to the eligibility and also the needs of some people that probably don't need to renovate or renovate to this level. So eligibility criteria. Basic things to know here is, first of all, you have to be an Australian citizen. You can't have just flown in from offshore and trying to cash in on it. And if you're an individual, you need to be on an income less than $125,000 a year, or a couple on less than $200,000 a year.
So still fairly decent, though, isn't it? I mean, that's not a bad.
Yeah, I mean, if we're not talking about the types of people Joel was discussing here, trying to get an extra $25,000. The timing is critical, so you would need to enter into a contract to renovate or build before the end of this year, and with construction to begin within 3 months of that date. So it's really designed to make sure there's builders and construction happening in the next 6 to 9 months. And for renovations, this is the thing that's probably going to exclude a number of people looking for smaller things, is the amount you spend needs to be between $150,000 and $750,000. So we're not talking backyard decks or a new fence. You need to be doing a serious amount of renovation to be able to justify it. So the $25,000
that you... spa and a pergola and everything else that goes with it.
Thinking of the new top level, the new story on the house.
That's definitely talking some kind of house extension rather than just remodeling the inside.
And also the other part of it, even if you meet the two criteria I've already specified of your income level and the amount of work you're going to be doing, the end value of the house, prior to renovating, the property mustn't be valued at more than $1.5 million. Okay. So you could be quite wealthy and have a nice property. You want to do some renovations, and maybe you're just taking a hiatus from work, so your income's down, but you're still wealthy enough to not need this compensation. So they've got the criteria in there for that as well.
But 1.5 mil is again, it's not a cheap house.
Not at all. No.
Yeah.
Especially if we look at the median house price around the country, it's more than double what the median is. So there's still plenty of people that will qualify.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And Brett, one of the things you haven't mentioned is first home buyers. Is it not restricted to just first home buyers or anything like that?
No. No, it's not a first home buyers grant. It's purely just a stimulus to the construction industry. So if you meet the criteria here, and of course, so if you're already a homeowner, you've gone past the first home buyers scenario.
Yeah, of course. Yep. So it's for people who are renovating an existing home or building a new home from scratch.
Yeah, or building a new home. And if you are building a new home from scratch, obviously the total contract price of the house and land can't be more than $750,000.
Yeah. Okay. What do you think about it from a government perspective? I mean, another handout. Do you think this is a good thing, or do you think that, you know, this is just another handout that we should be worried about and, you know, handing out more money as far as, you know, JobKeeper and all the other things that we've sort of seen at the moment?
Look, I think at the whole it's a good thing. Mainly because the construction industry is one of the biggest employers, and there's a lot of small businesses in the industry that could be under pressure, and this might be the stimulus to help them survive. There's a lot of tradies and subcontractors that this will flow onto.
Mm.
And typically some of the data that the government uses, they say that for every dollar spent in the construction industry, it flows on to around $3 to $4 spent in the economy as a whole.
Yeah. But this money's got to come from somewhere. I mean, how do we pay this back? How does Australia do it?
Well, I'm assuming the tax revenue and all of the other economic stimulus that comes out of, say, the $25,000, if that turns into $100,000 of money flowing, there will be a tax event that will start to flow back to some degree. I don't know whether it's an exact amount that will come back, but at least it keeps the economy moving.
Yeah. So you don't think it's not long-term doom and gloom for the average person that's sort of, you know, we're going to be footing this bill for quite some time? So,
look, I think we will see the budget. Yeah,
I think we will overall. I mean, this scheme is a $675 million scheme, but is it going to produce an economic benefit enough to pay for that? Well, it's going to keep people off of welfare, firstly, through direct employment of people. So it's going to save money on the other side of it, which is a cost that I don't know what the number is there. Secondly, those people who are in work will now have taxable income, so that money comes back. And that number that Brett's saying for every dollar spent actually goes around the economy 3 to 4 times. That means you're actually supporting the income of 3 or 4 people for every dollar that's spent. So
the government collects, not a bad thing overall.
Exactly. So and the government collects income tax off every one of those individuals. So I think it's the kind of scheme where if it does go around the economy that many times, then it's almost immediately paying for itself in addition to keeping people off of welfare and avoiding a steeper downturn than would otherwise be the case. And the other nice thing about this scheme is that they are just subsidising a higher level of cost. So by requiring other people to spend $150,000, they're just providing a bit of a supplement to encourage a higher level of overall spending. Which is a nice way to design it.
Good point, Louis. Like if that stat we mentioned, the $3 to $4 of additional economic benefit for every dollar put forward, the $25,000 results in say $100,000 of money sort of circulating. But considering you must spend $150,000 for this to happen, it really means that they're making roughly $600,000 get circulated.
Yep.
So in that respect, it probably is. I think it's a good scheme in that respect.
I think so. And where it will probably have the biggest impact is in builders who are building new house and land packages and just being able to promote that. I'm sure this will get mostly promoted to first home buyers, but anyone who's looking to buy a home in one of these new estates that is up and coming, now they've got an extra $25,000 incentive to sign a contract to get building started, and actually to sign that contract today or sometime before the end of this year. And that's going to provide a lot more certainty for that industry. And that applies to every city around Australia. I think it's net-net a good idea.
Yeah, good one.
And guys, I'll just touch on a last couple of points here. The government have learnt the errors of their ways. Do you guys remember the pink bat scheme and the yep. Hot water scheme
yes.
that was
yes.
rorted quite a yep. bit? So there are a few extra rules they've put in place here, which makes sense. So to stop, you know, all the sharks coming in and trying to get their hands on this money and rort the system, they've specified that contracts need to be negotiated at a fair market price, so it can't just be inflated. And to stop builders inflating prices because they know you're getting the $25,000 basically not out of your own pocket, you can actually specify that the contractor has to demonstrate that the cost is the same or lower than a comparable project in July 2019.
Okay.
So that's protecting people from being extorted. Yeah.
Yep.
Unfortunately, Joel, you can't ask your favourite uncle to do the work. The scheme requires that you have no special relationship with your contractor and you can't be related.
Okay.
There you
Sorry,
go.
Sorry, Dave.
Yeah. And, of course, the works need to be conducted by a registered or licensed builder. So they're making sure it's only those that are in the industry and are doing it according to usual market terms are getting the business and making sure it's actually going to be managed appropriately.
I'm sure there'll be someone that'll find a loophole.
Yeah, it tends to be the way, doesn't it? When there's money to be made, people always look for the loopholes.
Louis loves a loophole, just like
taking
money out of your super, but I won't touch on that again.
There's been some news on that this week as well. Maybe I'll touch on that after the break.
All right. Sounds good. All right, thanks for the update, Brett. Really interesting information. We're going to throw to another quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Welcome back. Louis, we might just start with that topic there about a little bit of more information that's come to light about taking money from your super over coronavirus.
Just on the fraud side of it, and a few articles written this week on people who have had it taken from their account without them knowing about it. And you talk about a scheme where they try and get it off the ground as quickly as possible. It's very hard to design a perfect system to avoid instances of fraud or rorting or things like that. And there's always that trade-off between getting a quick result and getting a good result. So people have found that the way that fraudsters get into their super is, well, firstly, they have their identity stolen. The information that's taken is enough information to set up a MyGov account. And probably the first flaw in the system is the ability for one person to actually have multiple MyGov accounts set up in their name.
Right.
So if you don't know what a MyGov account is, MyGov is, I guess, just the login side of it. To a government website, and once you've created that login, you then link different government services. So you link your MyGov account to the ATO's record, you link your MyGov to the Centrelink record, to the Medicare record, the MyHealth record, disability services, and all a host of other government services. So it's basically a way to avoid having multiple logins for multiple government departments. It's it's a nice, easy single login system. So you wonder why there would be the ability to set up multiple accounts, because what fraudsters have done is they've set up a second MyGov account and they have relinked the person's ATO record to that fraudulent account. And once they've got that up and running, well, then they've got full control to be able to request a withdrawal from Super.
Wow.
And because the questionnaires that you have to answer to qualify for the withdrawal of Super doesn't have any fact-checking behind it. It's all a self-declaration, which our entire tax system is, so you can understand it. And even if they changed it to being the other way around, it would be too long a process for people at the ATO to verify every claim before processing the approval for a payout, and that stops the money getting into people's hands quickly.
Louis, do you know how many fraudulent activities have sort of been happening with this kind of thing, or is it a small number, or is it growing?
I haven't seen any numbers around it.
But
I would expect it to be a small number.
Yeah.
And I would expect it to be relatively easy for the government to have a look at where are the likely cases of fraud after the fact.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm kind of surprised there wasn't something like this before the payment, because the easiest thing for the ATO to look for is when you go through the process, you nominate which bank account do you want the payment to go to.
Mm.
And I would have thought that the majority of people would have the same bank account for the superannuation withdrawal as they have for their yearly tax refund.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I would have thought that the ATO would have had a flag to say, okay, this person's requested a super withdrawal and it's the same bank account that we pay their tax return to every year. Beautiful. That makes sense. But hang on, here's a person who's requested a different bank account. Maybe that's a flag that we should, I don't know, just send the person a text message or an email or something to just confirm it was actually them. Even if it's just to send the person a message and just delay the payment for 24 hours to give that person an opportunity to respond if it is fraud. And if it's not fraud, well, then you go ahead with it a day later. And the other people I'm surprised didn't do anything about it was the superannuation funds as well. Have some kind of messaging system to say, hey, by the way, we've just received a request to process this withdrawal, but super funds have just gone ahead with the payments. And then people don't know what's happened.
It's like the banks. I mean, you get a notification when you're withdrawing a certain amount. So you think they have that technology there?
Yeah, that's right. Just a notification to say, hey, this has been received, because most people have logged into their superannuation accounts, or they log into their regular bank accounts where they have a super fund linked, and they just see that it's suddenly $10,000 less, and they go, that's unusual. I wonder what's going on there. And then they investigate it. So it's surprising that additional checks weren't in place.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So that's on the fraud side of the superannuation withdrawals. I suggest everyone logs into their MyGov account and just make sure that they still got the ATO linked. And also check your super fund balances. Make sure you've still got all your money there and there haven't been any withdrawals.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't actually my topic for today. What I wanted to talk about was something that people have been very interested in since the coronavirus event, for want of a better word, pandemic. And we find this always in times of crisis, actually, that people are much more willing to have their wills reviewed and talk about life insurance and disability insurance. It often takes a global pandemic for people to recognize, hey, I am actually a human, and death is a possible event at some point in my life. Well, in fact, it's more than possible. It's somewhat certain for all of us. I'm hearing from estate planning lawyers that they are very busy at the moment. And my own personal experience when I speak to people, in normal circumstances, when I propose to someone that they have their will reviewed or get a will where they don't have one right now, it's always sort of put on the back burner and not seen as something of importance. Whereas right now, in the last 2 months, almost everyone I speak to has said, that is a good idea and I'm going to do it right now. Who is the person that you can put me onto to get that done?
Yeah.
So, look, at UGC, we have a number of contacts with some excellent estate planning lawyers. So if you're listening to this podcast and you do need a referral to an estate planning lawyer, please get in contact with us. On the estate planning side of things, you can have a simple will put in place, but there's a few things that I look for, actually, and I've got a huge preference for wills that contain a discretionary testamentary trust. That will make it a more expensive will for a solicitor to prepare, but the discretionary testamentary trust is what allows your remaining family after a person's death to have flexibility in how they pay out the money. Firstly, in terms of being able to minimize tax. Secondly, being able to control the timing of those payments, whether they're paid as an income stream over many years or paid out in one lump sum, which means that there's a bit of protection around making payments to children or adults who still behave like children if they're over the age of 18.
Or 39,
correct. Protection around people who might, if there's adult children who are business owners, then you can actually protect them from bankruptcy if it just happens to coincide with the timing of a parent's death. Or people who are going through divorce proceeds right at that time of the parent's death. Then you can withhold the payment to that beneficiary and they're not entitled to it. Therefore, it's not part of that person's wealth when they're going through the time of divorce at the same time as a parent dying. Mm. So it gives a lot of flexibilities and the ability to manage tax. And something which some lawyers are not very good with is something called a superannuation proceeds trust. And it's similar to a discretionary testamentary trust, but it's specifically for the payout of a super fund because the tax rules around it are more complicated. If you've got either a substantial superannuation balance or you've got a substantial amount of life insurance within your super, which is going to be enough to leave an ongoing income stream or future wealth to your beneficiaries, well, then you should certainly be looking into a superannuation proceeds trust, again, to minimize tax and bring more control to your beneficiaries.
Yeah.
I don't think I need to go into more complexities than that on a podcast because beyond that, it becomes very specific to a person's circumstance. For example, is the amount of superannuation or life insurance, is that going to be a payout that is more than is going to repay the family home loan? Or is there an amount above that? And what is that amount? And what are the potential tax impacts? So it then comes down to some specific financial planning around the estate plan. So contact UGC if you need more on that. But that's the kind of thing that we do in the estate planning part of a financial plan.
Louis, I was just going to ask too. I mean, doing a will is such an awkward thing to have to do, and it's something that people put off because it is an awful thing to have to discuss. You're in fate. What happens if I don't have a will at the end of it? How does that all work, and how complex does it become for people that don't have one in place?
If your family situation is simple, then it becomes a greater headache for the people that need to distribute the will. So if you're part of a couple and you've got children, you're still going to have all the assets end up with the spouse and being able to support the children. But you're going to have to go through a more difficult process in order to get probate if there's not a will in place. So you're adding a lot of work to what a lawyer needs to do for the control of that estate to go to the spouse. It also leaves it more open to challenges if there are other family members in the mix. It used to be a lot worse than it is. Certainly Victoria have put through some laws that have really cut down the ability for distant family members to challenge estates. You used to have cases where some fifth cousin that no one's spoken to in years would just have their lawyer write a letter saying, I've got a claim to the estate, and then the lawyers have to start dealing with that matter, and they end up just paying a portion of it just to shut up that that distant relative. So those laws have been tightened up to really cut down on that sort of thing. But it does still leave a family exposed. And certainly if you have people in the relationship who have had previous relationships and children from previous relationships, then you're definitely opening yourself up to a can of worms and an ambiguity over who gets what and who's entitled to what. And all sorts of things. So you should definitely have a will if you've got a blended family.
Yeah. Well, certainly an uncomfortable topic for most people, but obviously very relevant to have one and very important. So if you haven't done one, I urge you to do it as well. It's something that we've had to think about ourselves, and I know it's not nice sitting there to do it, but it is an essential.
Yep.
Contact your GC if you need one.
Thanks, Steph.
All right, guys, we're going to now finish up with our favourite topic for the day, something a bit more lighthearted, and it's you can't be serious. I just wanted to mention one thing that I read on the news, not as funny as I'm sure your topic is going to be today, but has anyone seen on the news yesterday that the Commonwealth Bank had noticed that people are using, when they're transferring money from account to somebody else's account, you know that little couple of characters that you can type a message on?
Yeah.
You've got about 25 characters. People are actually sending threats to people if they're having a family dispute.
What?
And using that as a message into other people's bank accounts. So they're making transactions of like under a dollar and sending messages to people that they're having disputes with. Or else the other thing that they've noticed is a lot of people using profanities to transfer money to their mates. So this has come up as a really hot topic. And the Commonwealth Bank are now starting to monitor this, which I thought was quite interesting.
Interesting.
I'd never even thought of doing that.
It's innovative because I know with a lot of social media and text messages, you can just block people, whereas, yeah, if you're getting money, you probably don't want to block it.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Apparently, they've been coming up so regularly and people have been receiving all these threats and kind of strange messages to their accounts.
Well, Steph, I'll tell you a funny story. A number of years ago, one of my mates needed to transfer me some money. And in my bank account turned up sexual favours, payment for sexual favours.
That is hilarious. Well, there you go. That's the kind of thing they're going to be cracking down on.
Sounds like a good mate.
He's had a sordid history, Joel. Goodness me, you too. Anyway, so don't do it now because they are monitoring it. So you will be pulled up. So who's got one? Who's got a you can't be serious they want to start with?
Well, I've got one, Steph. I'll kick it off. It's not so much of a funny instance, but imagine you were a husband. It was your birthday. Your wife forgets to get you a birthday present, so instead she runs quickly down to the news agency, gets the first thing that comes to her mind, which is a lottery ticket, and bang, you're $350,000 better off as a result of winning the lotto. That's what happened to one lucky man in Bundaberg in Queensland just on the weekend, where the gold lotto jackpot went off on Saturday night, and this gentleman was one of 10 to share in the jackpot, pocketing $347,862.34 for his birthday. Thank you.
What a cracking birthday present.
Yeah.
Cracking present.
Jeez. Wish that would happen. Joel, just buy me a lotto ticket for my birthday. Make sure it's the winning one.
Yeah. You struck gold 6 years ago, baby.
Oh, well. I think I just vomited in my mouth. No, I didn't. You're right.
Guys, I want to give you a name to remember. Jenny Stejna. I bet you've never heard her name before.
No.
No, never heard of her.
Well, I think she's the talisman for the aging population in this battle against coronavirus, and possibly even a sign that we're starting to win this battle. She's 103 years old. And wow. She was diagnosed with coronavirus, and her family and great-grandchildren were told she wouldn't survive. But not only did she beat the virus, to celebrate, she videoed herself sculling a beer.
There you go. See, alcohol does keep you alive, Joel. All these times you've been telling me.
There you go.
Good on her.
Good on her. Guys, we've been talking about cardboard cutouts in the football stands. There's another unique way of having someone get enjoyment out of something, or not someone, but something fake. There's a roller coaster ride, a very old one in San Diego in America, that has to keep running every day in order to keep the machinery in good working order. So who are they going to take for a ride, even though it's running without people? There's a video online of it showing it's full of giant stuffed teddy bears being taken for the ride of their life. So
that's really cute.
They look like they're enjoying it too.
Yeah, they really do. Big smiles on their face.
I tell you what, though, I don't think I'd want to get on a roller coaster that needs to run every day to keep the machine working. That's a bit frightening.
It's a 95-year-old roller coaster, which I don't think is as old as the roller coaster down at Luna Park in St. Kilda.
I think that burned down at some point, wasn't it? It had a fire on there when I was a few years back, if you remember. All right. Well, thank you guys for all your input today, and I hope that you have a fabulous long weekend for everyone that's got the long weekend in. And enjoy it. I think you're off camping, Louis. Or not? Sorry, you're not camping, are you? You're going down
not
to
not camping, right? Yeah, just a holiday house down there. So that's going to be a good weekend.
Yeah. Well, have a fabulous time. I hope it's not too cold for everyone, but enjoy your extra day of freedom. And we'll be back next week again. Awesome. Do it again.
Thanks, Steph.
Have a good weekend, guys. Bye.
Cheers, bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.